A stone. Not a gun. Not a knife. Just a jagged piece of earth plucked from the ground in a moment of rage. It wasn't supposed to end like this. It wasn't supposed to be deadly. But on a quiet night in rural Iowa, that stone became the weapon that ended one man's life, ruptured a family's foundation, and revealed a betrayal no one was prepared for. Kevin Schwab was a father, a handyman, a neighbour you could count on. But when his body was found bludgeoned beyond recognition, authorities were stunned not only by the brutality of the attack, but by who confessed. The killer didn't flee. He didn't cover his tracks. He walked into a police station and calmly admitted it all. But his confession raised more questions than answers. What drove a man to kill with his bare hands and a rock? What secrets had been buried beneath the surface of their relationship? And how does a family survive when the killer is someone they once called their own? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favourite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Stone and the Silence. The wind rolled through the cornfields of Marengo, Iowa, in slow, methodical waves, like the town itself, where nothing ever really happened. The kind of place where the loudest sounds were church bells on Sundays and lawnmowers in the summer. But the morning of August the 12th, 2023, that silence was broken, not by a siren, not by a scream, but by the stillness of something terribly wrong. Kevin Schwab was the kind of man you didn't forget. Mid-50s, weather-worn face, blue-collar hands, a carpenter by trade, a fixer of everything, and a father trying to rebuild after a messy divorce. To his neighbours, he was helpful, reliable, harmless. He often spent his evenings tinkering in his garage or barbecuing alone in the backyard. He had two kids, grown, moved out, both living in Cedar Rapids. His ex-wife, Dawn, had remarried years ago. On that Saturday morning, the dog's barking was relentless. Hours passed, then more hours. By early afternoon, it was the dog and the silence that made the neighbours uneasy. Marcy Collins, who lived across the street, finally made the call to the sheriff's office. "He never left that dog alone for long," she told officers, "not without telling somebody. Not Kevin." When Deputy Travis Yunt arrived for the welfare check, he expected the usual: a forgotten cell phone, a miscommunication, maybe a night at the casino. What he found instead was the front door ajar and an untouched cup of coffee on the kitchen counter, ice cold. The house was mostly tidy, except for the back patio door, which hung open. Deputy Yount stepped into the backyard, his boots crunching lightly on dried grass, and that's when he saw it. Kevin was face down, partially curled, as if he'd collapsed mid-turn. The back of his head was caved in, blood pooled beneath him, dark and dried around the edges. Nearby, half embedded in the dirt, was a jagged stone, a landscaping rock, roughly the size of a grapefruit, smeared with brownish-red stains. The kind of rock you'd use to line a garden bed. The kind of thing no one thinks twice about until it becomes a weapon. There was no blood trail, no sign of a struggle in the house. Nothing stolen. The back porch light bulb had shattered on impact. Glass glittered like tiny diamonds in the grass. Within the hour, yellow tape sealed off the home. Iowa County Sheriff's detectives were called in. And that's when Detective Sandra Hughes took over. Hughes had spent 14 years working small-town cases, mostly petty thefts, drunk driving accidents, an occasional domestic disturbance. But this was different, brutal, messy, personal. She paced the scene with clinical precision. A rock isn't used on impulse, not like a gun, not like a knife in a kitchen. You have to pick it up, You have to lift it, swing it, again and again. That's rage, she later told the press. The crime scene team noted the angle of the impact. Kevin had been struck at least three times. Once on the side of the head, once on the crown, and again across the upper spine. No defensive wounds, no signs he'd fought back. Autopsy results would later confirm it. Cause of death, blunt force trauma. Time of death, sometime between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m, Friday night into Saturday morning. Hughes began her work backward. Who was the last person to see Kevin alive? A name surfaces. Jeremy Bowers. Just after noon the next day, Sunday, a man walked into the Marengo Police Department. Jeans, grey t-shirt, ball cap pulled low. He didn't ask to speak to a lawyer, didn't even ask for a drink of water. He simply said, "I need to report something. I killed Kevin Schwab." His name was Jeremy Bowers, 44 years old. No prior criminal record. A former employee of Kevin's, off and on for the past 5 years. He helped Kevin on home remodel projects, framing, drywall, cabinetry. Locals knew him as quiet but steady. Detective Hughes was called to sit with him. "I need to tell the truth," he said. "I hit him with a rock. I didn't mean for it to go that far." He said it happened during an argument behind the house. Something about unpaid wages. A shouting match. Kevin had shoved him, he claimed. He lost his temper, found the stone, swung hard. Then again. But even Hughes, a veteran at sniffing out half-truths, knew this wasn't the whole story. Something about the calm in his voice didn't match the savagery of the scene. Digging deeper. Jeremy's initial statement was oddly clean. Too precise. He described details no one outside law enforcement should know, like how the body was positioned, the shattered porch bulb, the number of blows. He knew, because he hadn't panicked. He hadn't run. After killing Kevin, Jeremy said he sat on the back steps for nearly 20 minutes, breathing, thinking. He left Kevin's phone in the grass, walked out the front door, drove home. Why confess now? I didn't want his kids finding out on TV, he said. Hughes didn't buy it. She pulled surveillance from a gas station two blocks away, around 11:45 p.m. Friday, Jeremy's truck was caught on camera turning onto Kevin Street. He hadn't mentioned that detail in his confession. More damning, Kevin's neighbour, Marcy, remembered hearing male voices outside around midnight. One of them angry, the other pleading. She thought it was the television. The autopsy confirmed Kevin died just after midnight. The family's collapse. News spread quickly. Marengo wasn't big enough to hide a murder. By Monday, whispers turned into phone calls. Kevin's son, Blake, drove back from Cedar Rapids in silence. His sister Natalie stayed in her hotel room for 3 days straight. Neither could make sense of it. "I grew up seeing Jeremy in our house," Blake told reporters weeks later. "He helped my dad build the back porch. He carved my initials into the wood steps when I was a kid." The betrayal was sharp, violent, personal. Then came the revelation that shifted the case entirely. Jeremy hadn't just worked for Kevin. He'd once dated Kevin's ex-wife, Dawn, briefly after her divorce, for a few months in 2021. It hadn't ended well. According to neighbours, Kevin had confronted Jeremy about it more than once. There was bad blood. And when police retrieved text records from Kevin's old phone, they found a message, never sent, written, but unsent, just minutes before his death. "If you show up here again, I swear to God I'll press charges." It was addressed to Jeremy, a murder of motivation. Why didn't Jeremy mention Dawn in his confession? Why fabricate a wage dispute? Detective Hughes believed the motive was layered: resentment, humiliation, rejection, and maybe something worse, unspoken feelings, unprocessed rage. She confronted Jeremy again. You were involved with his ex-wife. He threatened to expose you. You hated him for it. Jeremy didn't respond. He asked for an attorney. By then, the damage was done. Kevin's children began questioning everyone. Old friends, neighbours, even Dawn. The family fractured under the weight of suspicion. Did Dawn know Jeremy still harboured feelings? Had she warned Kevin? Had anyone? Aftermath. The trial began 6 months later. Prosecutors charged Jeremy Bowers with first-degree murder, arguing premeditation. The defense claimed manslaughter, citing emotional provocation. But the jury didn't buy it. The confession, the camera footage, the unsent text. It all told a darker truth. Jeremy was convicted and sentenced to life in prison without parole. Kevin Schwab was buried on a cold Tuesday morning beneath an oak tree near his childhood home. His son Blake refused to speak at the service. Natalie read a poem. Dawn didn't attend. Later that year, Blake sold the house. The new owners tore down the back porch. But the stone, the one used in the killing, remains in evidence, sealed in a plastic bag, tagged and catalogued. A weapon born not of design, but of fury, of betrayal. A single stone. Enough to unravel a life, destroy a family, and bury secrets too heavy for silence. Chapter 2. The Crack in the Foundation. By the time the indictment came down, the story had already spread far beyond Marengo. Carpenter murdered with rock in Iowa backyard, read the Des Moines Register. Small town, big secret. The bludgeoning of Kevin Schwab headlined a syndicated true crime podcast. National media only needed one thing to sink their teeth into: the image of a man murdered not with a gun, not with a knife, but with a stone. And in an age of overexposed horror, that simplicity was chilling. But for the Schwab family, it wasn't the press that made the weeks after Kevin's death unbearable. It was the silence. Kevin's funeral drew 100 people, neighbours, co-workers, even former clients who came to shake the hands of his kids. But once the casket lowered and the flowers began to wilt, so did the ties that held the family together. Blake couldn't look Dawn in the eye. Natalie stopped answering calls altogether. In the beginning, they told themselves it was just grief. But grief has a way of making space for questions. And soon, those questions started to take root. The man behind the confession. Jeremy Bowers sat in a 6x8 holding cell in the Iowa County Jail under suicide watch. His arraignment lasted all of 9 minutes. Not guilty. He said it without hesitation. Not with defiance. Just resolve. His defense attorney, Philip Redman, told reporters the case was tragic, yes, but not premeditated. The narrative painted Jeremy as a troubled man, provoked, overwhelmed by emotion, and ultimately remorseful. But something about that didn't sit right with Natalie. She remembered Jeremy from her teenage years. He'd worked alongside her father on several house flips. She remembered his work boots by the door, the smell of sawdust and sweat, the way he looked at her mother when he thought no one noticed. And she remembered something else. A time she caught her father yelling in the garage. She couldn't hear who he was talking to, but she'd never seen his face that red. When she asked him what happened, he said only, "Some things need to stay in the past." A family splinters. 6 weeks after the murder, Blake called a family meeting. It was a Sunday. He drove down from Cedar Rapids. Natalie came, reluctantly. Dawn arrived last, with her new husband trailing behind like a ghost. They met at Kevin's house, the one with the back porch torn down and boarded over. No one touched the coffee. "What do you think he's not saying?" Blake asked. It wasn't a theory, it was a challenge. Dawn looked away. Natalie looked directly at her. "You dated him," Natalie said flatly. "You knew Jeremy, better than you admitted to the police." Dawn didn't deny it. "Yes," she said, her voice sharp. "For 3 months. A mistake. One I ended." "Did Dad know?" Blake asked. "He found out," she admitted. "And he didn't take it well." "Did you warn him that Jeremy might still be around? That he might still be angry?" Natalie asked. Dawn's eyes narrowed. "You think this is my fault?" Natalie didn't answer. The room fractured. It had been cracked since Kevin died, but now the fractures were visible, spreading across the surface like spider webs in glass. The trial begins. On a grey March morning, the trial of Jeremy Bowers opened in the Iowa County Courthouse. The prosecution argued one thing: intent. Jeremy had shown up uninvited. Kevin had sent him a warning text, unsent but time-stamped. And the use of a stone, brutal, intentional, suggested far more than momentary rage. But the defense had a counterplay. They introduced evidence that Kevin had a temper, past altercations with subcontractors, a history of yelling, sometimes aggressively, when things didn't go his way. They leaned heavily on the idea that Kevin had provoked Jeremy. And then came a twist. The defense subpoenaed Dawn. Her testimony would now be on record, and everything she'd tried to keep in the past was coming forward. Dawn on the stand. Courtrooms have a way of swallowing sound. The buzz, the shifting of shoes, the whispers, all disappear the moment someone says, "Please state your name for the record." Dawn Schwab, now Dawn Keller, took the stand wearing a navy dress and a pearl necklace Kevin had once bought her. She looked composed, but her hands shook slightly as she raised them to be sworn in. "Ms. Keller, did you have a relationship with the defendant, Jeremy Bowers?" asked the defense. "Yes. When did this relationship begin?" "In late 2021. "And how long did it last?" "About 3 months." "Why did it end?" "I ended it. He was possessive, jealous. He had a temper." "Did you ever witness him act violently?" She hesitated. "Not physically, but verbally. Yes." "Did Kevin Schwab know about this relationship?" "Yes." "How did he react?" "Silence." "Ms. Keller?" Dawn blinked. "He was furious." "In your opinion, did he ever threaten Mr. Bowers?" Pause. "Yes." "And did Mr. Bowers ever express fear of Kevin Schwab?" "Yes," she said, "more than once." The courtroom murmured. This painted Jeremy not as a calculated killer, but as a cornered man, desperate and afraid. But then came redirect. The prosecution stood up, straightened his tie, and asked the one question no one had prepared her for. "Did you warn Kevin that Jeremy had shown up at his house the week before the murder?" Dawn froze. I wasn't sure he had. He said something strange, but I didn't want to." "Please answer the question, Miss Keller. Yes or no?" "No." The answer was soft, devastating. A gasp echoed from Natalie's side of the gallery. Blake closed his eyes. Natalie's doubt. That night, Natalie couldn't sleep. She sat on her childhood bed in her old room, now emptied of posters and paint, and scrolled through her father's digital records, bank statements, call logs, appointment notes. She didn't know what she was looking for, just that something didn't feel right. Why had Jeremy waited to confess? Why show up the next day if it was truly a moment of madness? She opened an old folder marked 2019 Remodel, Lisbon. It was a shared project her father and Jeremy had worked on. Inside was a client list, job notes, and then a letter, a folded note, printed from an email. You know what happened back then. I kept your secret once, but you don't scare me anymore. The email had no sender name, no date, but it was signed with a single letter. D. Natalie stared at it for hours. The verdict. After 5 days of testimony, 3 days of deliberation, and 2 hung jurors, the decision came down. Guilty of second-degree murder. Not first degree. Not life without parole. Jeremy would serve 35 years with the possibility of parole after 28. The courtroom was divided. Some believed justice had been done. Others whispered about secrets, about Dawn's omissions, about the things not said under oath. Natalie didn't speak to her mother after the trial. Blake moved to Colorado. The Schwab family, once held together by the rituals of Sunday dinners and football games, was now a ghost of itself. Scattered. Severed. And Jeremy Bowers. He said nothing. He walked out of the courtroom in cuffs, his eyes forward, his face unreadable. But the story wasn't over. 2 weeks after the trial, Natalie returned to her father's property for one final walkthrough before the house was officially transferred to its new owners. She walked the empty halls, stopped in the garage, ran her fingers across the scratched surface of the workbench where he'd built her first dollhouse. Then she stepped out back. Grass had grown over the blood-stained soil. The porch was gone. The dirt was packed down. But something still felt wrong. She stood in the silence for a full minute before walking to the edge of the yard, where the stone garden had once been. There, half buried in weeds, she saw it. Another stone. Smaller than the murder weapon, but similar. Jagged edges. Weighty. A quiet presence. And next to it, something else. A glint of metal. She bent down. It was a locket. One she remembered her mother wearing. Inside, 2 pictures, one of Natalie, and one of Jeremy. Chapter 3, The Last Piece. The locket should have been dust by now. It had sat in the elements for over half a year. Rain, frost, heat. But the clasp still snapped shut with a soft click. Inside, the 2 photos had faded, but were unmistakable. One of them showed Natalie as a toddler, cradled in her father's arms. The other was grainier, black and white. Jeremy Bowers, maybe in his 20s. Smiling. Shirtless. His arm around someone cropped out of frame. Natalie didn't know what she was looking at. Not yet. But her chest went tight. She turned the locket over. There was an engraving. To my only truth. D. She stood motionless in the yard, her fingers trembling around the tarnished chain. That night, she didn't drive home. She booked a hotel outside Iowa City and stared at the ceiling, replaying the last 6 months like a reel on loop. Kevin's murder, the trial, the quiet things Dawn never said. And then it struck her. If the locket was Jeremy's, why was it hidden under the dirt? And more important, why was she in it? Reopening wounds. The next day, Natalie requested her father's case file. As a family member of the victim, she was granted access. She pored through crime scene photos, phone logs, emails. She revisited Jeremy's original statement. The language chilled her all over again. It got out of hand. I didn't mean to kill him, but he threatened me, threatened to expose everything. Everything. Not me. Not my record. Not my temper. Everything. What had Kevin known? She pulled her phone and called Blake. I need you to meet me, she said. No more of this, Nat, he said. The guy's in prison. Let it go. But she couldn't. And deep down, she knew he couldn't either. A box in the closet. Kevin had kept journals, spiral-bound, half-full, mostly ramblings about measurements, supply costs, things he wanted to fix in the house. But in a small locked box in the back of his bedroom closet, one the new owners had set aside for the family, Natalie found something else. A printed DNA test. Not from Ancestry or 23andMe. This was old school, basic, from a local lab. Two names, Kevin Schwab, Jeremy Bowers. Below them, a single result. Probability of paternity, 0.00%. Natalie blinked. This wasn't a paternity test for her. This was a paternity test for Blake. The secret. Kevin had submitted the test just months before his death. There was no note, no explanation, just a folded receipt from the lab and a manila envelope labelled, "If anything happens to me." But it wasn't addressed to anyone. Natalie stared at the paper, her breath caught in her throat. She called Blake again. This time, he picked up. "We need to talk," she said. He came that evening, quiet, exhausted. He hadn't been back to the house since the day of the verdict. She placed the locket and the test results on the dining room table. "I think Mum lied to all of us," she said. "Blake read the test. Then again. Then he laughed. Short. Bitter. I always wondered," he said, "why I didn't look like Dad. Why he started drinking harder when I was 10. Why he never came to my high school graduation." Natalie whispered. She had an affair. With Jeremy, before the divorce, before everything. They sat in silence for a long time. Finally, Blake said, "I think Dad found out. I think that's what everything meant." The final visit. Natalie drove to the Iowa Correctional Facility the next week. She didn't schedule a formal visit. She just showed up during public hours. When Jeremy saw her name on the log, he agreed. He looked older, more tired, but not surprised. "I figured you'd come," he said. She placed the locket on the glass between them. "Why did you keep this?" she asked. His mouth curled into a faint smile. "Because once, I thought your mother loved me." "And Blake?" she asked. He didn't answer. "You're his father, aren't you?" He nodded, slowly. "But you let Dad raise him. You let him believe." "I didn't have a choice," Jeremy said. She didn't want it to come out. Kevin found out years later. Threatened to ruin everything. So you killed him. Jeremy looked up, eyes hollow. I wanted to talk to him. He wasn't supposed to die. But when he said Blake would never know the truth. I snapped. Natalie's voice cracked. You stole our father from us. No, Jeremy said. Dawn did. Confrontation. That night, Natalie drove straight to her mother's house. Dawn answered the door in a robe, eyes widening at the sight of the manila folder in Natalie's hand. Where did you get that? She whispered. You should have told us, Natalie said. You should have told him. Dawn's voice went cold. It wouldn't have changed anything. Kevin couldn't forgive me. He hated me. He hated Blake. He didn't hate Blake. He was his son. No, Dawn said. He wasn't. And Kevin made sure we all knew it. Natalie took a step back. You protected Jeremy, even after what he did. I didn't know he would kill him, Dawn said. I just wanted the past to stay buried. But it didn't, Natalie said. It crawled back with blood on its hands. The last stone. Months later, the Schwab home was bulldozed and rebuilt. The new owners planted grass, installed solar panels, fenced off the backyard. The past paved over, but Natalie kept the locket. She never told Blake about the prison visit. She never told her mother about the DNA results she planned to mail to the parole board, just in case Jeremy ever applied. She did, however, give her father something back. She returned to the site where he died, planted a single stone, upright, like a marker. No plaque, no flowers, just the words, etched in her handwriting. He raised us when no one else would. That was enough,